Hey, this is Brie Bagwell with Only Vans, and here's another recording in front of a live audience at Music Fest in Steamboat, Colorado this year. Thank you so much to John Dixon and everyone at Music Fest for making this happen. Today, I'm joined by two amazing human beings that I've known for over a decade and a half, Brennan Anthony and John Randall. Brennan Anthony has recently been named the vice president of Big Loud Texas, which is a record label that is founded by Miranda Lambert and John Randall. It's a branch of the Big Loud record label, which has artists such as Morgan Wallen, Miranda, Hardy, and Haley Witters, to name a few. Before that, Brendan was the director of the Texas Music Office and was instrumental in the creation of BMI Texas and the Texas Music Incubator Rebate Program, which supports music venues in Texas with over $20 million in tax rebates. We talk a lot about the other great things Brendan did for the Texas music and music-friendly communities, and even I was fascinated by it, and I learned something new. You can also find him playing fiddle on stages with people like Pat Green. No big deal. John Randall is the co-founder of Big Loud Texas and has some hits you may know as a songwriter, including Whiskey Lullaby, Tin Man, and many of your new favorite Hold My Beer Volume 2 tracks by Wade Bowen and Randy Rogers. His producer credits are equally impressive. Dierks Bentley, Parker McCollum, Jack Ingram, Pat Green, Miranda, you get the picture. They're both funny, down-to-earth, approachable, and they truly care about art in the midst of a time I've been referring to as the Wild West of music. When John Randall also called it the Wild West, I almost fell off my chair with validation. Don't forget to subscribe and share this episode, and thank you so much again to John and Brendan and Dirt Trail Entertainment for sponsoring these very special and very cold Music Fest episodes. Enjoy. Hey there, this is Brie Bagwell with Only Vans, and we all know that vinyls are back, baby. Well, they have been for a long time, actually, and my friends at Hand Drawn Pressing have got you covered. They just finished up a reprint of my vinyls, and they really walk you through the entire process. I picked out a different vinyl color for this run, and they're red and black. Oh my gosh. They offer so many color options, and you can also put in inserts in the vinyl jackets or download cards. They can make your customized vinyl dreams come true. They pay for themselves so quickly, it's insane, and their turnaround time is quite impressive, if I do say so myself. Also, they were at my show the other day, like we're friends in real life. How cool is that? They're a Texas-based independent plant helping artists help themselves. Get your vinyl manufactured in the USA by my friends at Hand Drawn Pressing. You won't regret it. Tell them Brie and Whiskey sent you. Go to handdrawnpressing.com for all the info and check out their awesome content on Instagram. Their handle is at Hand Drawn Records. See what I mean about him messing up? It doesn't really happen. It's like, I was waiting for, like, one time me and Pat Green got drunk in Mexico. Like, that's the...
So, one time.
Hey, hey, everybody. This is Brie Bagwell, and this is my podcast, Only Vans, where I talk to my friends. They know Vans. Cheers, everybody. Thank you for coming to the live filming of my podcast. It's pretty crazy to... I didn't know if you would have told me years ago I'd be a podcaster. Here we are. But we started just talking to my friends in my van, my music business friends, and Ed Helms from The Office, Andy from The Office and from The Hangover. He started the Bluegrass Situation, and they just picked up my podcast last year. So it's a very big deal for us. We are widely distributed. And now I just get to drink champagne and not have to sing and just talk to my friends. It's kind of like the dream. So... anyway, I'm going to introduce to you two people that I've known for a very long time, and I'm really excited for y'all to meet. Brendan Anthony and John Randall is also here, too. So welcome, my friends. Warm welcome. I was thinking about just how long I've known both of you guys, and I remember very, very distinctly when I was playing in college at Mother Egan's Irish Pub on 6th Street. And I called my mom and I said, oh my gosh, Mom, Pat Green's fiddle player was at my show. Do you remember that?
At Mother Egan's, yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to tell you what year that was, but 2009.
I caught myself not mentioning years a whole bunch.
Well, it was such an honor that you were there. And I remember kind of picking your brain back then about the music business. And
No, gosh.
I know.
listen, you should have told me just to be a doctor. You did not do that. You were like, go for it. We need more girls. That was so nice. You were an early cheerleader of me, and I so appreciate it. And most importantly, Paul Eason thinks that Brendan Anthony is the coolest looking human being.
Where's Paul?
I know. Where is Paul? Oh, he's here. Yeah. Oh, he's like, he's like, Brendan Anthony had the coolest clothes on today. And, yeah. So not only do you have a lot to talk about, you know, professionally, but I would really like you to know that about my boyfriend, because he's a cool looking dude. So.
Oh, I'm flattered, brother. That means a lot coming from you, man. You've got a very strong hat game. Always. Yeah.
Yes, he does. And John Randall, this is funny because we wrote a song together when I was at Sony up in Nashville years and years ago.
And John Wiggins.
You and John Wiggins. Yeah. I remember because I told my mom, I'm writing a song with the guy who wrote Whiskey Lullaby and the guy who wrote Tequila Makes Her Clothes Fall Off. And she said, that should be an interesting song.
And we didn't write a drinking song. Can you believe it?
We did not. And I told Brendan, I ended up cutting that song and putting it out illegally because it was like a Sony demo and I just released it. So.
Too good not to cut.
Yeah.
Too good.
I probably owe you 17 cents, John Randall.
That's all right.
I love it. I want to start out by... if you guys want to talk about Big Loud Texas, what's really exciting to me is there's been, in my mind, such a big shift of Texas versus Nashville from the time that I started in music to what it is now and how everyone is kind of really paying attention to what's happening in Texas. And it used to kind of be like, okay, a little Texas band. And now it seems like they're like, you're doing really big things down there. We want a part of it. And what I love is that people are coming from the outside kind of like, hey, what are you doing down there? And now we have... someone in Texas with an inside perspective who you guys actually have been there, you've done it, you know the ins and outs of it, and I'm so proud that you're finding such great talent in Texas. Good job.
Thanks. Yeah. We're really excited about it. I think two really important points now in this day and age, when a Texas act or a Texas writer makes his or her way to Nashville to go work in that scene, you know, typically they'll keep roots in Texas, and the fan base that they built down here, or in Texas rather, will cheer them on. And that was not always true when my generation of Texas artists was coming up. And look, we fueled that too. I mean, we certainly did our part to create some division there. I think we were really possessive of the things we made, and the fan base was very proud and maybe possessive of those artists as well. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't as much of a cheering section when deals happened elsewhere that were set up to further that artist's career. That's all changed now. And when Nashville, which for generations now, I mean, it has been generations, acknowledges that a Texas writer is on par with the system, the incredible songwriting system, the incredible distribution system they built up there, and we cheer it on here, you know, we fuel those machines as well. The agencies are full of Texas artists. The labels and publishing companies are full of Texas artists who've made their way up there permanently, semi-permanently, or work out of Texas and participate up there. I just think a lot of the divisions that we're getting hung up on, perhaps artificially, have just moved aside. And that is a really good indicator for things to come. And that is why I think Big Loud Texas is so important. Our partners at Big Loud have been tremendously successful in the commercial country world. And this is a further acknowledgement that things are being made in Texas and things can be a part of that system and have a huge chance of success. And we're really excited about the prospects of that.
Mm-hmm. And we've all been, I mean, my whole team's in Texas and has been for a long, I mean, mm-hmm. in Nashville and has been for a long time. PR team, my booking agents, mm-hmm. publishing deals. And so for me, it was never really like, I hate Nashville. It's kind of like, that's where we go to get things done. And that's where the best studio musicians in the world are. And I love to cut my records up there. And it's not the stigma that it was. I will say there is still a little bit of it where I've had it happen a bunch where labels will sign a new girl and they'll send them to Texas to do some shows with me. And so we'll go around and every manager or label person is always, they're like, this is a whole thing down here. And they're still a little bit surprised when it's like, you know, sold out Mucky Ducks, Saxon. And the fans are listening and they're really attentive and they're really loyal. And so I really wanted to do the Nashville thing. And I did a little bit, but I was already making money in Texas. That was my job, playing music. So it wasn't like I could quit and go. So now I love that there's this hybrid where you can do music in Texas, and then I went to all these new states this year. Everyone's really following it. People like Cody Johnson have really blown the doors off what's possible for a Texas artist.
Parker. Yeah.
Parker.
Aaron, the list is longer now than it has been in a long time,
mm-hmm.
of people from those venues, those Saxon type listening venues, all the way up, you know, to our friends at Green and Billy Bob's. That, you know, that used to be the ceiling, mm-hmm. if you were going to be a Texas act. And hey, good for you if you can sell Billy Bob's out. But there's something else out there, you know, and there's that hybrid that really can take you to new places. Opportunities are endless if you buy into that system a little bit more.
And people are really hungry for Texas music, like the genre. People, all the states we go to, there's Boston Red Dirt fans, you know, mm-hmm. or, and then Florida Red Dirt Country Club, and they all come out, and they're so enthusiastic about, and they're so happy that we're getting outside of Texas, and so are we. Like, that's what we've always wanted. And I think a lot of times people are like, oh, you're just a Texas thing. It's like, no, that's where I make the bulk of my living, and I'm so thankful for those fans and those venues, but I obviously want my music to get to as many places as possible. It's not,
I think John can really speak, and he has an amazing perspective going back several years in Nashville. He's had a tremendous amount of success. He's participated in artist deals, publishing deals, and knows them inside and out. And he can really attest to the chain reaction that happens when something really great finds its way into the system that can amplify that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I would always ask John, and I'm so proud to work alongside with John at Big Loud Texas, and it gives me a tremendous opportunity to ask questions and learn every day about how these things work. But you know, that sort of chain reaction of events that can happen when the right thing finds the right team in a place like Nashville that's uniquely suited to do that is something that John's been participating in for years now. And we're really lucky to have that focus on what we're doing down here.
Well, and you know, one kind of back to one of the things you're talking about, it's the internet also, for the good or bad of whatever we want to say about those things, it's opened it up for Nashville used to be the gatekeeper for country music. You pretty much had to go there, get a deal, and get a song on the radio for anybody to even know that you were making records. And that's why you're finding fans all over the world right now, because they're able to access Texas music in a thousand different ways, and they're finding it, and they're loving finding it, and so that's what has helped blow things open, I think, more than anything. And I know for us, you know, all of us have been working in Texas forever. I lived in both worlds forever. And I know that, you know, every time I worked in Austin or in, you know, making records or recording, it's like, gosh, songwriters are here, artists are here, musicians are here, studios are here. Where's the record company? Yeah. Where's the people that can wave this banner, you know? And so that's one of the things that, and you and I may have even talked about this at one point, but all my friends from Texas would come to Nashville and write. And one of the things they always pointed out was, we love coming here because there's a coffee pot to stand around. There's a home base. You guys all stand around and the legends are out smoking cigarettes on the patio and everybody's writing songs and there's this creative collective energy going on. We wish we had that here. And so that's one of the things we're trying to bring, is just that kind of infrastructure. And we know how the system works out of that. And we've got great partners in Nashville, but maybe we don't all have to go there to do everything. You know,
I love that. I mean, we all threatened to write, you know, down in Texas. Me and Josh Ward have been threatening to write songs for 10 years. We never have. And it's like, well, when you go to Nashville, your appointment's at 9:30 and you need to be there and you need to not be late because you get a bad rep and you don't cancel last minute. And when I was at Sony, that was the thing that I learned was, you know, this isn't like a, hey, we should write. It's like, Brie Bagwell didn't show up today or she was late. Like, you can't do that there. And that's not, and I love the business aspect of that and the discipline. And we all crave that because we kind of get away with, you know, I will say we're all on the road a lot, so we're pretty tired, but you still need to get up Monday morning and write songs if you want to call yourself a songwriter. And I love that about Nashville.
Yeah.
It's the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm so excited. John Randall, this is embarrassing, but my mother bought the talent. She was a talent buyer for the Southern New Mexico State Fair. Mm-hmm. And you played there when I was a youngin', and I had a John Randall baby, won't you come home on my poster on my wall for a long time. And when I went to Ride With You, I didn't tell you that story, I don't think. But and now you're producing a Miranda Lambert record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk about that journey into producing. I mean, it kind of feels like a natural thing for you when I see from the outside. It's like, of course you should be producing, but...
Well, it's the journey. I moved to Nashville. I was a bluegrass kid in Texas, and there was a cool bluegrass scene in Texas, but all the cats were in Nashville and North Carolina. And so me and some bluegrass buddies moved to Nashville, and that's kind of where my journey started. I toured with Emmylou Harris's bluegrass band and played with Sam Bush, and then I signed some record deals, and then I had publishing deals, and people started recording my songs. It's just a natural progression of the, you know, getting older in the business and whatever, growing in the business. And that led into producing. And, I've been blessed to work with all my heroes and a lot of my friends, a lot of our Texas friends. When it came around to this Miranda record, it goes into this conversation because we were, and during that time, talking about starting the Big Loud Texas imprint. And we're like, man, let's make this record awesome. Let's put our money where our mouth is. We made it at Arlen Studios with cats, musicians, and engineers, everybody from Austin, and a couple of Nashville guys we brought in, one of her guitar player from her band, and
my producer, Rachel Loy, played bass.
Rachel is unbelievable. She was so important to that session. Really, just, it was amazing what she brought to that record. But yeah, we cut that in Austin, and it was like, we were saying, look, this is what we can do here.
Yeah.
But I'm loving it. And that's part of another great thing about this label is I've worked with so many Texas friends, and I'm producing Parker and producing William Beckman. And it's like, I want to do this on our own label. If I'm going to produce all my buddies, I want to do it in Texas with my friends, you know?
Oh, I know. Oh, moment. Chills. It's fine. And I love, Brennan Anthony was a part of the Texas Music Office, if you don't know that about him, for a long time. How long were you doing that for?
I mean, just a shade under 10 years.
Yeah. But you have kind of this like deep desire to help the music scene in Texas. That's like, I don't know where it comes from, but like, I remember talking to you one time and the light that was in your eyes when you were trying to help the Austin live music scene, which calls itself the live music capital of the world. And then you were trying to get, you know, cover charges for the venues who are having their artists, you know, the bands play for 8 hours, and you're trying to get the set shortened. And you were just like, you were just leading the charge and like the glimmer of light and hope in your eyes. And we're so thankful that, you know, we all talk about it, but you were actually taking action.
Well, that's really kind. I really do appreciate you saying that. The opportunity that was presented to me at the end of 2014, when I got a call from Governor Abbott, and he voluntold me to come join his office. The Texas Music Office, if you don't know, is nearly a 32-year-old, 3-year-old agency now, and it's within the office of the governor. So you can imagine the kind of power it can have with the right direction. And so what I realized quickly when I was asked to do that and then was appointed and joined the administration in 15 was that I had a tremendous responsibility and opportunity at my feet.
Hey, this is Bree Bagwell, and if you want to listen to this podcast early and ad-free, subscribe to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/BreeBagwell.
Are you ready to take your merchandise to the next level? Well, just ask me who I use, and that is CH Lone Star Promo. They specialize in screen printing and direct-to-garment, embroidery, laser engraving, anything promo-related, they can do it. Step up your merch game now with CH Lone Star Promo and tell them Bree and Whiskey sent you.
And to waste that, of course, would have been a horrible move, but I really started thinking about what we could actually do with a state agency devoted solely to the growth and support and advocacy for the Texas commercial music industry. And imagine that if someone came to you and said, I know you've been working and participating in this Texas commercial music industry in a few ways for your whole adult life. How would you like to serve it? And, you know, really the earliest meetings I had with the governor were like, what do you want to do? What do you want to do with this agency? If you need my help, what would we do with it? And he said, take as much time as you need and come back. And we started building things. And that was really probably where you saw the light go on, mm-hmm. was that we decided, we drew lines in the sand. We said, we're going to approach this from an economic perspective. We're going to learn the economic impact that these people have when they go to work every day. We're going to learn how that affects the state from a tax implication perspective. We're going to figure out where these people are and what voting districts they are, so that when any sitting representative or senator had us in the office and they said, well, that doesn't happen in my district, we could say, it absolutely does, and this is exactly who's doing it, and this is exactly their contribution in their home community. And we just started building from there. We brought the first of several economic impact studies now that are available online at texasmusicoffice.com. And we went to work building satellite offices because an initial problem I saw really early on is that as a head of a state agency, I couldn't pick the phone up and call anyone else in the state and communities large or small and ask what was going on there. I could, of course, call on friends around the state and say, hey, what's happening in your community? But it was not official and there was no process around it. Yeah. So to date, the Texas Music Office, and I'm going to stop saying we eventually because I was involved in it for a decade, but the Texas Music Office has to date built 70 plus offices around the state that listen to people in communities, every major city in the state and the communities all the way down to places like Lyndale. I mean, that's the population spectrum. They've built listening posts within city government that can actually learn and listen to people that live there, that do the things we do in Dallas and Houston and Fort Worth and Lubbock and Amarillo and Midland and the Rio Grande Valley and Houston, all over the place. And so when I did call, they would say, well, this many people are going to work in our city that we know of through our surveys. This is what their problems are. And those programs began to take on a life of their own, where they would actually build programs that were responsive to the people who live there. So this was not heavy-handed bureaucracy or government coming in and saying in a prescriptive way, you need to do X, Y, and Z to serve these people. It was listen to the people that live there and then do what they tell you to do. And that, in my mind, was good government. And then at the same time, we moved into lawmaking. And we worked in D.C. and we helped pass laws. We helped stop what we thought were some silly things that were happening. We talked today about moves that the Department of Justice were consistently making under a particular administration that were bad for creators of intellectual property in our space. And we pushed back on that. We actually sued the DOJ. We pushed back and we worked with sitting congressmen to push back on those things. We helped pass laws in D.C. We created, through lawmaking in Texas, programs like the TMIR, which every 2 years puts $20.2 million back into the music venue economy. Music venues can apply to get over $100,000 back every single year off their mixed alcohol beverage tax receipts. And that's game changer on a razor-thin margin business that they operate. And the list goes on. The music office was really important. Germane to our conversation, the widening of lanes that we hope to forge between industry centers like Texas and Nashville in particular was a main focus. We invited and created the BMI Texas office, which was a first step in acknowledging that there are bedrock relationships that need to be made for singer-songwriters in the state that simply did not exist for some reason. And so we helped build things like that. And many things formed around that. CAA now has permanent presence. WME has permanent presence. Mm-hmm. Big Lab Texas exists now. It's a cumulative effect of an effort that we started in 14. And it's so great to see those things come to fruition. What I ultimately hope it did, though, all of those things are great. They're processes that are run by amazing people at the TMO still. What I hope that they did was create a real recognition of the value that you create every day when you go to work, that Paul creates, Paul creates when he goes to work, that all of our friends that we know that are on the roster playing up here create, the real value that they create economically and culturally when they go to work every day.
Well, I just wanted free tacos. You didn't get that done for me. Free tacos for musicians on Tuesdays. I told that you that, like a... and you didn't follow through.
I'm sorry.
No. It's really important work, and I will say that cause as someone who plays those venues, they proudly display their venue certification on the wall. And I think the reason it's so important, and I was really reflecting on this for our end of the year podcast, is that music has seen quite a polarization in terms of, like, there's stadiums and then there's, like, the person in the corner playing the 3-hour gig, and the people that are in the middle, the venues that are in the middle and the artists that are in the middle seems to be the ones that kind of got hit the hardest with this division. And it's, if those 500 person rooms go away and those mid-sized, they're the ones that are struggling. So for you to create those, you know, incentives and those, the way to give back to them, it's like, that's how people like me have a job. It's very important.
I think that's true. And what we did that I think was the very most important, yes, we added a ton of money to it, but the 8-year process it took to get to the money part of it did some really important things along the way. We're the only state in the country, Texas, that can legally define in statute what a music venue is. And it separates it from bars and nightlifes and every other kind of business that pays tax into the state. So we legally, in law, we made a law that defined what a music venue was. And then we went further and defined it as an incubator venue, because these are the venues that promote an artist's career from the very beginning stages up to when they go play the stadiums. And we set that threshold at 2,500, I believe, is the cap. And so that's everything from, you know, our friends at Mucky Duck and the Saxon all the way up. And that is a tremendous spectrum of artist development right in the middle of that. And we're the only state in the country that legally said, this is a place that's important to us.
I'm an incubator.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was doing that this whole time. I'm
going to
add that
incubated
to my resume. That's incredible.
That's right.
Oh my gosh. How do you feel about the live music Texas thing? I mean, you've been in Nashville for a long time, but you've also played shows. So you kind of had your feet in both worlds too. I mean, you see any changes I think it's just so important to play live. Like, and I can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine if that all went away. And I think a lot of people in Nashville, it's so weird because they want to come to Texas because they get to play shows, you know?
Yeah.
And so we have to really protect that. And I'm very passionate about it. If you can't tell, but
that's what, I mean, that is Texas. So many careers were built on live shows. You know, that's one of the things that's going on right now, is there's a lot of people that are busting the doors open on streaming that have never made music outside their bedroom, and you go to see them live and they've never been on a stage before. You know, it's an interesting time for that. It's not that the music's wrong or anything, but that's one of the unique things about Texas, is the building and building and building. I mean, that was Parker McCollum, you know, he's making his records, but watching that grow to the point that it got to, until every label in the world was like, hey, all right, how do we get you to the next place, you know? And that's another thing, too, that labels can do. Like, a lot of artists build and build and build and build, and they hit that ceiling, and that's when they need the help to get to the next, if they want to go to the next place. And so I think Texas is, I mean, that's our bread and butter, is the live, and, you know, building your career and your audience, you know?
And I've got a lot of respect for what Parker and his team have done, too, and I think he's an interesting example to lean on for this discussion, because Parker did make a name for himself playing in the smaller rooms and making records early on with Lloyd Maines, and doing things in a place that he understood his home, and he grew from there. And I always said, and not to add to any talk of division, but I always said there's you know, an interesting thing that happens if you go directly to Nashville, and now if you go directly via social media channels to a wide swath of people, you really quickly need to follow that up with something that's going to accomplish very nearly the same thing quickly and over and over and over again. Whereas, and that's fine, whereas in Texas, I always said, from the cradle to that point where you need the label help and the machine help, we meet our fans face to face over and over and over again as we're learning. And you introduce new things to them, and maybe they work and maybe they don't, and you see what works and what doesn't. You go through band changes, you get better at playing as a band, you get better at presenting that stuff. And then by the time you need the help, you're in a pretty good space to realize what you are and what you're going to be. And, you know, there's a lot of room in the middle, but I genuinely feel, and not to take anything away from folks who are having success via channels that get them out there faster, all brands of social media, I'm not singling anyone out here. I genuinely feel that those people that can take the time you know, to learn, hone. I forgot who said it, but you know, you take the first 100 songs and throw them away, and then continue.
Radney Foster.
That was Radney.
It was a Radney. Great.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm glad we attributed that.
Yeah.
Because you know, you take the first 100 and throw them away. Now I feel like the people that are finding their audience so quickly, whether that's through traditional commercial music apparatus or you're going through a social media, you know, world. They're not getting the chance to throw 100 songs away. They need to throw a single after single after single out quickly and maintain that hold, or their trend line starts to drop and someone else comes along and their career is... It's not over, but it's not going the direction it should be.
Yeah.
And I don't ever get mad at, you know, it is a little tiny bit frustrating sometimes to see it when you're like, what is it? And they go...
Yeah.
And then... But I really wish... That would happen to me and all my friends too. So it's not like a hateful thing, but I definitely feel like almost anything could go wrong on stage and I would know how to handle it just because I've done a thousand times.
And that
would be slightly terrifying to have your ear pack go out and you're not sure what, you know, the first time that goes down and it's in front of thousands of people.
That's why you'll have a long career.
Oh. Slow right up, slow right down, John Randall.
You're a pro, you know.
Bev Lambert told me that. Yeah. So,
well, you know, the thing too is there's a thing going on right now where people are building. They're not thinking about legacy, thinking about product. Let's get product out there. Let's just do it. And the thought process of artist development, you know, back in the old days, they just keep throwing it out there and throwing it out there until they figured out what worked. Everything's moving really fast. And it's like, how fast can you move it? The other thing that's happening too is, you know, a lot of artists blow up really fast. And it's like, you've had your whole life to make your first record. Then it blows up. And now you've got 6 months to write another record as great as the one that you spent your whole life writing. That's when you need
people,
collaborators and friends that you trust and a team around you to help you focus on getting the next project when you're touring your butt off and, you know, there's not all that free time to try to be creative at 2 a.m.
That's such a good point. And I have concern. I wouldn't say it's a worry. I have concern for the artists that get to the spot and then they build a team really quick because there's something there, you know what I mean? There's a there. And then they're immediately put into this cycle and they don't get any grace period at all.
Yeah.
To figure out who they want to be. And they're really young. And that's, you know, some can manage it and some can't.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, I wish I knew who I was at 16. I didn't. It took me a really long time to find my message and my sound. And I kind of love Texas music so much that I was like, okay, I need a beer song. I need a boots. I need a whiskey song. You know, I kind of checked a lot of boxes. And now that I'm kind of comfortable and able to kind of settle and be like, what do I want to say? And so this last record I made with Rachel was just so me, but I realized it was the first record that I made without a publisher, without a record label, without a manager. Mm-hmm. So to have that cleared headspace allowed me to create the art that I wanted to create.
Yeah.
But when you have the opportunity to sign with a manager, you know, which I did, or a label, which I did, and you're also, for me, it was always like, well, they're going to give me the money. I can't record this record without the money. So it's like the monetary pressure, and you never know what's going to be the right move for you and what's not. And I wish, you know, I hate some of my friends that have also been put on the back burner and lost in the machine. That just, it breaks my heart, you know? So that was always a little bit of a terrifying thing for me. What, I'm going to go all in, go to Nashville and then get on a label and not be able to put out my own record. Like, how frustrating that is and tragic, really, you know?
Yeah.
So I just really love what y'all are doing. And I also have worked with so many people who aren't musicians, which it's so comforting to know that you're signing these great people like Jake Worthington, who I think is just one of the greatest.
He's
like,
wonderful.
So great. So hilarious. He told my friends his aunt smells like chicken spaghetti last night. I don't know, but he's just so wonderful. But when you're working with people that play instruments, write songs, that doesn't always happen. And it was always so weird for me because I would be like, you don't get me because you don't even play an instrument.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I had this conversation with George Massenberg and Josh Leo years ago. Josh Leo was in a bunch of great bands and produced a ton of great records all from LA and in Nashville. He's a legendary musician, and he ran RCA Records. He was running RCA Records when I moved to town. But in the early, think about this: Chet Atkins ran RCA Records, one of the greatest musicians, producers of all times, and a performer. And for all those years, the head of the label or the head of A&R was a record maker, was a musician or a producer for years. When I moved to Nashville, the head of the, at least the head of A&R, was a legacy producer that had been in the studio and making records for years. That went away sometime in the mid to late 90s, on up until now. There's really no one at major labels that have ever seen how a record's made. They're selling a product that they don't even know how it's made.
I'm going to get up and hug your face right now. Well, I've been saying this.
Well, it's just, I just find it interesting because as a producer that works with these people, and I have great friends, and I'm not dogging anybody. I just, there's a miscommunication sometimes when I'm trying to explain or have them explain to me what they don't like about something that we've turned in. But they don't know how to tell me what they don't like. And it's like banging your head against the wall. And that's what I do love about us all being in this team together with Miranda, is like we and our partners are all creatives. Our partners that own Big Loud are all musicians, and half their staff is as well. So the communication is already about music, and art is leading right off the bat. And so that's you know,
that's beautiful.
I hear what you're saying.
Well, they probably told you that, you know, 4-minute sad songs about whiskey and dying weren't good too. And look what you did.
Yeah.
You said, "An angel sang whiskey by," and then, well, then you told them, right?
Nothing like a 4.5-minute double suicide to get you on a drive time, get you home from work.
Yeah. Great stuff. So the format, I mean, I always think back to when I started and there was kind of no real answer. You know, I was just kind of like, what are you doing? Cody Johnson's wife is like, I have all his CDs and I printed out all the radio stations' email or mailing addresses and I'm mailing them all. And there was kind of no real roadmap. And so I feel like when you're talking about legacy, sometimes I think that mine is maybe at least giving, if a girl's like, hey, how do I get a song on the radio? I can at least maybe provide some sort of insight to how that works. But now that's all changing. And I don't know whether it's like, this isn't the way anymore. Now I'm kind of like, I have no idea what to do. And a manager in Nashville recently was like, none of us have any idea what to do.
Yeah.
It's just a strange time.
It's the Wild West right now. And, you know, I go back to, I toured with Emmylou Harris when I was, you know, a young musician, and I signed my first record deal when I was in her band, and I was terrified. I didn't really know what I was getting into. And she just said, you know, at the end of the day, you just have to make your music. That's it. It just goes where it goes. It falls, it flies, whatever. But just at the end of the day, we're creatives, and all we can really do is try to make the best music we can.
You know? Yeah, and not to oversimplify anything, because it's not simple. It's really complex. The industry is, or the business we participate in, you participate in, we do in our way, and so many of our friends do. It's not easy. The lifestyle's not easy. It doesn't reward necessarily the things you think it should or does. It definitely rewards professionalism in the end. It rewards relationship building in the end. But the target for hitting something that's going to mark a level of success moves around, and it moves really quickly. And that can present, you know, confusion, but it can also present a ton of opportunity if you're willing to, you know, not shackle yourself to one idea of making it. You know, there's definitely, you know, in major label world, there needs to be an indicator of success via standard channels. This needs to be a radio hit. But more and more, we're seeing that good music from different genres is meeting in the middle, and it isn't being siloed off And you're seeing performers collaborate with one another that 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, wouldn't have been in the same room with one another. Mm-hmm. And their songs are getting out because they're good. A lot of times they're great. And they're making their way to people who are making the decision about what they're going to listen to. Radio is super important. Mm-hmm. And don't ever let anyone tell you for the time being that it isn't. But in addition to that, there are a whole bunch of ways to discover things. And there are a whole bunch of ways for those things to become successful. I don't think we're here to get into the deep, dark debate about how much streaming pays the average creator. But once you make your way to a level where, you know, a label has negotiated streaming rights that are somewhat more advantageous to the artist, mm-hmm. streaming does really matter. I mean, it always matters, but genre doesn't necessarily matter as much. Playlists matter, that sort of thing. There's this whole wide range of opportunity there that if you're smart and if you're nimble and if you're willing to be creative with the artist and the team you're working with, you can find a way to success that maybe you didn't have in mind 5-10 years mm-hmm. ago.
Mm-hmm. I think it was Callie Fry's manager, Alan, who told me everything is important. And I love that.
Everything's important.
It's like everything, the relationships, the radio, streaming, you know, the TikToks, whatever. It's everything is important. And that kind of does become a big burden for an artist, as you all know, because you're feeling like everything is important all the time, and that can get heavy. But I love what you said about the art mattering, and that's why I was so excited when you agreed to do this podcast, because it does matter. And you're still like, you're going to be playing this week, right? Like you're playing fiddle with Pat. When are you playing? Do you want to plug your shows?
There's an outdoor show, and I think that's happening today after tomorrow. And then there's one up top where he's going to do some old school stuff with Corey again, which should be really fun.
Fun.
I wish I had those times and locations down pat for you. I'm sorry.
I love when I've never seen Brendan Anthony not know something. This is like the greatest moment. We're going to play this on repeat. Make this a highlight reel, Kyle.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Wow.
Coming up. It hasn't happened yet.
There's an app for that. Yeah, it's
there's
okay.
There's an app for
I'm also on the outdoor stage. It's a fun one.
Yeah.
I love it. And John, what are you doing this week?
I'm playing.
Playing tonight.
Tonight, 8:35
at Dung Beetle.
Yeah,
I do know that.
He does know that. I didn't know that.
No. Wow.
Managing my schedule is less important than making sure John can sit in a big room like this and wow everybody. So
I'm playing here at 8:55. Who scheduled me and John Randall at the same time? John Dixon, did you do that? Sorry. Okay.
I'd come see her. I might sit out and come.
Whatever. I did want to just take a couple of questions from the audience, but it's very fun. I had Max and Heather Stalling on here yesterday, and they just popped in, and Max said, you should ask Brendan Anthony, what would the Texas Music Office had fired you for if they knew you had done in your career? Or what? Something along. And I was like, I've also never seen Brendan Anthony misbehave, so that probably doesn't exist.
Right. I don't think they would have retroactively fired me for anything I did when I was a musician and thought I would be forever, so I'm just taking that off the table.
Okay, good.
I think going to that office every day instilled in you a sense of respect for who you were working for. And I don't mean, I do mean the governor and his team, but more importantly, and I think you would agree that we went to work every day to serve the people of Texas. So I could imagine being let go from a job if I ever conducted myself in a way that was not serving both of those entities in the most respectful way I could.
See what I mean about him messing up? It doesn't really happen. It's like, I was waiting for, like, one time me and Pat Green got drunk in Mexico. Like, that's the...
So one time, we played a show, and I'll keep this very brief. Yeah, we played a show in Acuña at the Corona Club, which if any of you ever got to experience that, man, what a time. It was a different time. Things happened differently. We went down and we left our bus on the other side of the bridge and went over, and the opening band graciously allowed us to use their backline and everything. So we were free and easy and wheeling. Jenna Bush was a contemporary of ours in a time in Austin, and she and her team reached out to see if they could come down and see the Big Pat show in Mexico. And her father was president of the United States, and I didn't think that was problematic in any way, shape, or form. So we're like, yeah, backstage, you're all fine. So she brought her team down, and I slapped, you know, the things on everybody, and they were fine. they were standing side stage. We were playing our show. They were there for a minute. And then after a minute, they were not there. And security was doing this. And they were gone. And I felt responsible for this. And they had made their way to another part of town where more exciting things than us were happening. And their Secret Service detail could not accompany them to that spot. So the Mexican Army, the Army was called, and the Federal Police were called to go remove them from that place and deliver them safely back to the United States. And when they were explaining how all of this happened, they were like, oh, the band gave us backstage, and we just decided to go. And they had to call the boss and her dad in the middle of the night and explain to him that the guy from Pat's band had gotten their daughter into trouble in Mexico, and now he's awake, and we're on DEFCON, something different than it was 10 minutes before that. Had I done that during my time, I might have been asked to leave. I will say that.
Amazing. Yeah. We were on the Texas Country Music Cruise with Pat a couple of years ago, and we had one of the best days. We went to the bar that, I guess, Pat's monitor guy just like bought the bar in Mexico. They played there, and then he just moved there and bought a bar there. So Pat took us all to this bar, and they flew out of Cancun, and we all had to go back to the boat, and we went to pay our tab, and Pat Green had bought the whole bar's whole tab in Mexico. And it was the coolest. It was just the coolest. I love Uncle Pat. He's the best.
Some might have lied to him about the exchange rate.
Climate.
We had one of the most infamous things happen during spring break one year. And one of our members made a jab to a guy walking up the beach about the Lakers. And the guy didn't like that. And so he took a swing at Pat. And Pat's a big dude. But Pat was out cold. one thing. And I chased this person down who knocked the 6'3 guy out. And this guy was holding me under the water in the waves, and they tackled him and took him away. The news outlets came. Texas Monthly did a thing. The governor sent people down. David Letterman called us. And I can't get away from that story anywhere. That was 90 years ago, and I can't get away from the story.
Well, that's what's wrong with Pat. He got knocked in the head. Just kidding. We were going to do just like one or two audience questions. We're already almost out of time, but does anyone have a question for these very accomplished, wonderful people that's appropriate and G-rated or PG-rated at least? Anybody at all? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Pat and Corey are at 10.
Thank you, Bob.
At Thunderhead.
At Thunderhead.
45, Thursday at Thunderhead. AI and what that means to artists, and how can we as consumers make sure that we're taking care of the right people?
I'll say something about it, and I know John.
I'm going to repeat the question. Yeah. Sorry.
Good.
It was something about AI. I wasn't paying as much attention because Kyle was running at me. But just for the podcast listeners,
Look, I'm not foolish enough to think that AI is not going to impact the business we work in. Okay. So I would never stand up here and sit up here in front of you and say, AI is not important. It doesn't matter. It absolutely does. It absolutely will have an impact on how our business works. Mm-hmm. How and how far-reaching and how in-depth, we have no idea. AI is an amazing tool. It can simplify processes, make things more efficient, and a whole bunch of other superlatives that I think we can throw at it. But it absolutely will not remove a human from the songwriting process. You and I could give AI a prompt to create a song, and they will never, ever write a song like John can write. And I really do believe that. So we can put legal boundaries on it. Attribution's going to have to be super important. If someone is using AI to create something and they create something wonderful, I have no problem with that. If they use something of someone else's and AI's helped them do that, that should be illegal, in my opinion. But I honestly don't see a way we remove human beings from the purest part of a creation of intellectual property. And that applies to a whole bunch of different disciplines. But that's a technocratic answer, and I'm sure John has something better to say about that.
Well, I really don't. I mean, trust me, they're talking about it in every music office today. It remains to be seen. I mean, it is an incredible
It's a great tool.
I've seen, I mean, I won't say who, but I sang the demo on a song that I co-wrote. Engineer took the artist's voice, dropped it into me singing, and it sounds exactly like this artist. You would never know that I was anywhere near the studio, when in fact the artist was nowhere near the studio. Those are the things that people are trying to get ahead of in our business, and figure out the legalities on that. I mean, that, because that would be illegal. I did see a thing the other day that was interesting, where people are using AI to create the jingles for their commercials, for their branding and things, and that's going to take some work away from people that's their bread and butter, is doing, you know, placement work and jingles and movie soundtrack kind of things. So, you know, we're all watching it, but I don't have an answer for where it's going to go.
And please take this in the spirit it's intended, and I mean this with all due respect. There's got to be, at any given moment in an industry that's verging on a technological transformation, there has to be an acknowledgement of that fact. If you're digging your heels in, not acknowledging that it's happening, you will be the victim of that. Yeah. The music industry in particular has fallen victim to that at several phases of its evolution.
Very much so.
Ask your toll booth operator friends how their career is going right now. I mean, I know that's oversimplifying it, but we have to acknowledge that these things are changing. We can't wish them away, and we can't not participate in them in a way. The smarter we get with them, the more useful that tool will be for our industry. Yeah. If we do not acknowledge it, it will have detrimental effects far more rapidly than if we adapt to them. And so we have to do that.
Agreed.
And we also have to put legal statutory bumpers on these things as it makes sense.
I agree with that completely. Napster was a great example. I know that's what you're referring to, when we got caught with our pants down with technology and never caught up to it. I will say just one funny thing. My kids got on an AI program and prompted a song lyrics in the style of John Randall. I'm quoting quotation marks here. I'm not third personing myself, like some artists we know. John Randall would never do that. And it was funny because it sounded like a John Denver song. It was all about pine trees and flowers and butterflies. It was so hippie trippy. Like, it made me go back and look at my lyrics and go, am I that, like,
I do that?
Am I that high all the time?
It was just funny. That's a great question. That's
great question.
It's not on the horizon. It's sitting at the windshield.
I'm actually a robot and I cloned myself because I'm tired and I needed two of me. Okay. Next question.
No kidding.
One more. I think we only have time for one more. Anybody else?
Don't be scared.
Don't be scared. If not, I'm going to ask a dumb one. It's what I do best. That's why I have a big podcast deal. I mean, I guess, you know, what I think is a cliche question, but at the same time, the thing that I think about most is, where do I put my time, right? And you could put all your time into social media, and that might not matter. You could put all your time into, what do you think for an artist is the best use of their time? Because it used to be, what I thought was, when I was starting, which did kind of work out for me, was playing live shows. I played 15, 20 shows a month for a long time, you know, and I went to all the radio stations and I built a career off of that. I do not think that that's the way anymore for an artist. And in fact, I think it will burn them out and it won't be good for them. So what would you say is the new?
Well, I think there, again, it comes back to acknowledgement. There has to be an acknowledgement by artists today, as much as it might bug them, that they are a multi-dimensional small business, and you have to acknowledge that it is different than it was 5 minutes ago, different than it was 5 years ago. You would like to get to a point, you, Bree Bagwell, other artists, where you can focus on the things that as an artist really matter and only give them focus, and trust that other parts of your business are being handled by people you've brought on to manage it. Until you move into that point where those trusted roles are filled, you do have to sort of put together a time portfolio where you work on writing, you play the shows that you think are going to matter, and you're going to end up playing some that, you know, in the long run maybe didn't matter as much, but you're going to keep in the market. And you have to create a social media presence that matters and that's personal and, sorry, authentic. I know we are so sick of that word, but it actually means something to you. You're actually telling.
I was about to say the same.
I'm so sorry, but you're telling people something through these channels that actually matters to you, and so you have to focus on those things. Songwriting is still one of the most important parts of our business. Creating relationships that will allow you to co-write better songs, and working on your craft so you can have confidence in yourself that you're writing stuff on your own that's wonderful as well. That takes so much time, as you know. And then focusing on keeping that touring operation going, focusing on keeping the dollars from your merch operation going the way it's supposed to go. Managing your business with someone that you trust to do that. I mean, once you get to a certain point, some artists make the mistake of giving everything over to people that don't normally, or maybe don't always have their best interest in mind. That's a problem. So you always have to kind of keep a responsible eye on what's happening. I would say it starts with songwriting and creation, and it moves up in level of priority, or maybe down in level of priority, but all things are important. You have to start there and then maintain focus during the day on five different things.
Right. Okay. That is, yeah, so 35 hours in one day. Right. Yeah, no, got it.
But you're operating, and I always told people this when they came to talk to me at the office or when I was playing or whatever else. When you put your name on something and you're going out and selling things to people and you're out in the market, you may have a team, you may not, but you're a small business and you've started a business. And as an artist, your name's the one up there. Like, I, as a side guy, and Pat and I and other artists that I played with over the years, we had this conversation all the time. Like, I understand that Moore is riding on this for you. Your name's up there. If you decide to quit and go do something else and you've garnered fame with your name, you'll always be associated with that. I have had a career where I've moved around to different things and no one's really looked sideways at that, because now some artist that they used to know to do one thing is doing something else. The name is so important.
Yeah, and not to be hard on yourself too, because I mean, there's a lot of girls that they'll talk to me and they're like, I said, what you're doing is so much harder than what I'm doing, because I know, because I did it. Like, you're driving yourself. You have no, like, I have a PR team, a booking agent. And so it's like, in those early stages, I think that's the hardest thing that you can do, because you're doing it all with no outside help. And we want you to know that you new people are very important, and that Big Loud Texas, their whole mission to find and nurture new amazing talent in Texas is very important. And if you don't keep, you know, the fighting the good fight, which is very hard, that's what you guys are trying to protect, is the amazing talent that is coming out of our state. And I really thank you for that. Thank you for your hard work. And can you give these two amazing men a big round of applause?
Thank you
for coming on my podcast.
Brie. Thank you, Brie.
And if you want to say anything last, or tell me how good I am at podcasting, and anything you want to end on, I'm just kidding.
Well, look, I'll just say this real quick, because I think it applies to everyone in our business. You don't have to know everything on the first day. There's a lot to know. It's going to take time. This is a career. John's right. Look, if you're interested in being in this business, you should be interested in being in it for a long time. Your legacy is important. The relationships you make along the way are ultimately going to be as or more valuable than the stuff you create along the way, too. You cannot do it alone, but you also don't know it all on the first day. Mm-hmm. And don't be afraid to make mistakes, but keep your eye on where you want to be. And professionalism goes an awful long way.
Yep. Amen.
Amen. Okay, we'll end it right there. Thank you guys so much. Thanks for coming, y'all.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Brett. Thanks, producer Kyle.